Я решила баллотироваться в президенты России.
Я приму участие в борьбе за пост президента
России. Известная российская телеведущая Ксения Собчак.
Алексей Навальный сегодня объявил о намерении баллотироваться на пост
президентская кампания 2018 стартовала.
They're both products of the Bolotnaya protests. Both emerged as political figures during the mass demonstrations that engulfed Moscow in the winter of 2011-2012. Both came to Russia's opposition movement as outsiders and had to overcome skepticism. Both appeal to the young generation, and both have built large and loyal followings on social media. The socialite former reality television star and the tough-talking anti-corruption blogger could hardly be more different. But the political relationship between Ksenia Sobchak and Alexei Navalny has now become ground zero of the Russian opposition. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, The Vody, which will be published next year. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for the plug.
Ah, always glad to plug it. I'm looking forward to reading it. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is journalist Anna Artunyan, author of the book, The Putin Mystique. Welcome back to the podcast, Anna.
Great to be here once again.
Great to have you once again. You know, it's easy to be cynical about the Sobchak presidential campaign. The dominant conventional wisdom is that she cut a deal with the Kremlin and agreed to be the token liberal candidate in exchange for something like being allowed back on state-controlled television channels. Sobchak's candidacy, the argument goes, will help legitimize Vladimir Putin's inevitable coronation by generating excitement and boosting turnout in what everybody understands as a Potemkin stage-managed election. It also appears designed to neutralize Navalny, who will not be allowed in the ballot, but who nonetheless threatened to be a disruptive factor from the sidelines by campaigning anyway and mocking yet another fake election between Putin and obedient housebroken opponents like communist Gennady Zyuganov and nationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky. Now, I've broken with this conventional wisdom and have taken a less skeptical view. As we all know, elections in Russia are not about the result. They're about the show and they're about the narrative. There are legitimization rituals in which the Kremlin needs to tell the people a compelling story. In short, they're show business. And Ksenia Sobchak knows a thing or two about show business. And I don't rule out that she's playing her own game here and could wind up spoiling the Kremlin's show. Her ploy to stand in for the old against all protiv всех line that was removed from the ballot under Putin suggests this. The very serious team she's putting together, including Igor Malashenko, who ran Yeltsin's 96 campaign, Vladislav Inozentsev, a highly respected economist, and Alexei Sitnikov, all suggest, and incidentally, just before coming in the studio, I saw that Stanislav Belkovsky was also joining her campaign. But the key variable in my view is how she interacts with Navalny. If they work in tandem, him on the outside and her on the inside, it could provide a powerful dynamic that could spoil the Kremlin's ritual, Putin's inevitable victory notwithstanding. But if they operate across purposes, it plays right into the Kremlin's hands. Now, when the idea of Sobchak's potential candidacy was first floated, Navalny was dismissive, calling her, quote, a caricature of a liberal candidate. But after being released from jail last week, where he was serving a 20-day sentence for organizing unauthorized protests, Navalny appeared to soften his stance, telling supporters in Astrakhan that anybody has the right to run and he likes some candidates more than others. And Sobchak appears to be bending over backwards to reach out to Navalny, praising him as a brave and important figure and pledging to drop out of the race in the unlikely event he is allowed on the ballot. Mark, you wrote about this today. What's your take on Sobchak's candidacy, and what's your take on the dynamic between her and Navalny?
Well, I mean, I'm actually much more in the cynical camp. Never let it be said I'm not happy to take the easy route when it actually comes to Sobchak and her candidacy. But on the other hand, and again, this was the essence of my column today, I mean, I think this could well precisely have disruptive impacts on the political situation. Because, look, first of all, let's just address the issue of whether or not she's a real candidate or not. I mean, it's clear that this is something that has been discussed with the Kremlin for quite some time. It doesn't come as a surprise. And frankly, it doesn't even look as if the imperative, the initiative came from her.
I agree. I would agree with that.
It's interesting that on the one hand, she's making certain sort of, you know, she's now saying that Crimea was wrong when in the past she didn't seem to have a problem with it. She's willing to precisely praise Navalny and such like. But interestingly, I mean, apart from the fact that she's also very critical of Surkov, and I can't help but think, if someone was behind this, it would be Surkov. And I can almost actually say, actually imagine Surkov saying, oh, and by the way, make sure you pile into me just to gain some credibility. But on the other hand, she's also made it very clear that she's not going to criticize Putin personally. And that's interesting because that's always been one of Putin. You know, Putin and his family are off limits. And the very fact of this team that you mentioned, this very high-profile team, people who were not willing to jump on board with Bolotnaya and Navalny, are happy to come on to Team Sobchak. And these are people who are not firebrand radicals. These are not...
No, these are professional operatives.
Exactly. These are not Udaltsov in suits. These are people who I think would not have done so if someone somewhere had said, it's okay, guys. Don't worry about it. We're not going to be coming after you for doing this. So I think that this is a part of a polloi. But, as I said, to give you a little sort of... shred of comfort that I'm not entirely trashing what you're saying. As I said, I mean, I think it's more that it's not that I think there's intent, but I think the actual impact precisely may well be disruptive, precisely because exactly this is theatre. I mean, you said the elections aren't about the result. Well, I mean, I think actually I would say the opposite. I think the elections are all about the result. It's how you get the result that you need. And the trouble is they clearly...
But they're more about the theatre than the result. If the theatre's good... You're going to get the result you need, regardless.
Well,
that's going to happen.
I mean, the result is going to be there. But, I mean, again, I think what they need to do is they're trying to balance getting the right kind of result without having to do too much really overt rigging. Because I mean, that's dangerous.
I don't think we disagree that much. Because I think if I were to psych this out, I would say Sobchak is doing this precisely for the reasons you said she is. And the team that joined her is doing this precisely because they feel like it's okay and it's sanctioned. But all of these people, I think, are totally not down with the way things are going in Russia. And they see an opportunity within the confines of the system to be subversive.
Yeah, but I mean, exactly. I don't want to try and get into too many people's heads. But yeah, I mean, these are not... hardcore supporters of the Kremlin. This is not the Kremlin's political technology team. But I think the thing is, again, to this business about, I think, the disruptive capacity. I mean, the thing about Sobchak is precisely that she is a media creature. That is what she is. And by putting her in the election, obviously they're hoping to sex it up and so forth. But it does absolutely break the fourth wall. Mm-hmm. It makes it clear the extent to which this is theatre. And the last time we saw that fourth wall broken was with the castling.
Yeah,
that's exactly what happened then, and that led to Bolotnaya.
Yeah,
actually that I think necessarily that Sobchak is thinking of these terms, or maybe not even the very smart people coming to her team. But my take is that I can see the surface appeal. This is a classic piece of late Putinism, something that kind of in the short term looks smart and sneaky and effective, but in the long term might well actually be really quite disruptive.
And I'm reminded of research that was recently published by Daniel Treisman at UCLA about how authoritarian regimes turn into liberal regimes. And he looked at over 200 cases between 1800 and 2015. And only a third of those cases was it an intentional liberalization.
No,
all the other cases, were because of mistakes and miscalculations.
And particularly, it's because they think they can manage a kind of a controlled shift. You know, the sad truth of the matter is that authoritarian regimes tend to survive so long as they are nasty, brutish authoritarians. It's as soon as they start trying to get a little bit more clever, a little bit more flexible, that they usually open the door to collapse. So exactly, I mean, in some ways, if we were thinking of this as a, I mean, who knows about the individuals concerned, but a sort of a challenge between kind of Volodin mailed fist politics and Surkov sort of clever, smart-ass dramaturgia, this feels much more like a Surkovian move. And actually, frankly, it's the Volodin approach which would work.
Well, yeah, I mean, not to get too deeply into this research, but sometimes that approach will lead to the collapse of an authoritarian regime as well. When you needlessly use violence,
it's unfortunately much safer for authoritarian regimes.
But it was only a third of the cases where it was an intentional liberalization. But I would add on this team, I mean, this is really an A team. I mean, Malashenko, Shklarov, Sitnikov, these are serious people. And you know, Zemtsev is, I mean, I don't think he's not a creature of the regime at all. He's a pretty much an independent economist. If you read what he's writing. Anna, let's get you into the conversation here. You're patiently sitting there in Moscow. What do you see?
I'm beyond cynicism at this point. I think this is going to be disruptive. I agree with Mark. I think it's going to be disruptive for Navalny. I think it might be disruptive for the Kremlin. But in the short term, I think the Kremlin is really going to win out by, you know, this kind of, despite the short-sighted opportunistic gesture, which I see this being, it is going to be very disruptive for the liberals. It is going to be very disruptive for the Navalny camp. The thing is, by running for president, Sobchak is really putting Navalny in a difficult situation. And Navalny is smart enough to be aware of this. And I think everybody who's anybody is aware of the tension here. He can't really speak out. And yet, I think that...
Why can't he speak out?
Well, okay, let's say that he says tomorrow what he essentially said in the beginning, that, you know,
she's a caricature of a liberal candidate.
Exactly. What if he says that in more stronger terms and says, actually, you know what, this is not a good thing, because technically speaking, it's not. What is she? How exactly is she going to help Navalny? I'd actually like to stop on this point for a bit, because I do see your point when you say that her working on the inside, him working on the outside, and if they collaborate, they can actually make something happen. But she's not actually going to be working on the inside. She's not going to be working at all. She's a candidate. The only thing that she achieves in terms of helping Navalny is getting to say his name on state television a lot more. That is something. But, however, let's look at where that something actually leads the Navalny supporters and helps expand his base. I don't think it will. I think it might actually serve to divide. Because Russia's liberal opposition is, it's riddled with these divisions. It's a very incohesive camp. There's a lot of premium placed on loyalty. There's a lot of premium placed on stance. After what Prokhorov did, which I heard described by Belkovsky, by the way, as lying down under the Kremlin. I'm sorry for the crudeness, but I mean, people in Russia do speak about these things in very crude terms. How is that? What kind of light is that going to cast on Sobchak? And afterwards, how can somebody like Navalny really? I don't want to say he's not going to stop respecting her. I mean, they're friends, they're allies. They're not going to want to ruin their relationship. But there's really very few decent ways he can get himself out of this. Like, say, yeah, she's doing a good thing, yay, when clearly that's really not how most of his supporters feel. Or remain silent and not really bring this up in hopes of not creating a rift, which would play into the Kremlin's hands. I think he's going to stick with the latter. I think his best bet is to keep as silent on this as possible, because the Kremlin is going to weaponize every opportunity of a rift between them and use it on state television to show, well, here's the real face of the opposition. You want to vote against all. This is the kind of people you're voting for. This is what Navalny is. This is what Sobchak is. This is what they're really about. They're not serious candidates. You've got Sobchak, who's just, you know, a celebrity in it for her own benefit, and you've got Navalny, who is clearly not a leader if he can put up with this.
Mark, what's
so
your...
I don't see this playing out well for Navalny at all.
Mark, what do you think?
Yeah,
I'm not sure I'm with all of that.
No, I'd agree with Anna in the sense of, I think the thing is, look, firstly, exactly, there is no particular way they can cooperate. It's fine getting Navalny's name on TV, but remember, this is in the mouth of someone who, according to the sort of the polls we've seen, is well known but not well liked. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is it. Everyone knows her, but they actually don't regard her with any kind of affection. So actually, her constantly talking up Navalny, one questions whether it actually really sort of helps him or whether it makes it look as if, you know, associates him. When he has made a lot of effort into precisely trying to look like a serious, sober, even statesman-like candidate, to actually be connected with that. And I think what this does is it dilutes Navalny's brand, for want of a better word. It dilutes his appeal. And remember, given that Navalny is not campaigning so much for this election as to build the basis for a long-term game, that's where he actually is going to be taking hits.
Well, let's run with that a little bit, because this is the heart of my argument, that the result's a foregone conclusion. Navalny's not going to win. He's not going to be allowed to run. Sobchak's not going to win. Putin's going to win. We all know that. The question is, how does he win? And if you're looking at this stage of the process, the goal of the opposition, I would think, would be to disrupt that, to spoil the show in any way you can. And if you have Navalny running a very serious non-campaign on the outside, and you have Sobchak on the inside praising Navalny, reiterating his talking points, which she's been doing, quite frankly, you could end up with a powerful dynamic there. It's kind of yin and yang. Yeah, he's made serious efforts to come across as a very serious, sober-minded candidate. She, I think, doesn't get enough credit for presenting herself in a very sober way. Yeah, she's a former reality TV star and a socialite and all that stuff too. But she's if you watched her press conference this week, it was pretty sober and serious.
Okay, but one could just as easily say, what about her very first statement when she was saying that she's going to be going for election? When she basically said, exactly, vote. It's a vote of protest. It's a vote to say enough. You're not going to be voting for me. I mean, it really was actually much less of a presidential appeal, and much more, I felt, as a sort of sophomoric exercise. I think, look, the point is this. I mean, yes, we could envisage a carefully choreographed campaign in which sort of Sobchak sticks to trying to look like a serious, meaningful candidate who is precisely channeling Navalny in the elections.
But she said she'd drop out if he were allowed in.
Oh, yeah. But again, I mean, let's face it. We know that's not going to happen. So that's an easy thing to say. That's an easy way of basically showing your allegiance.
I saw it as messaging to Navalny, basically. I saw it as reaching out to Navalny.
Maybe. But again, I mean, you know, if we were thinking of this, again, if I was in the Kremlin thinking about it and I was creating Project Sobchak, this is exactly the kind of thing I'd be telling her to do. Because these are easy points that don't cost you anything. They make it look as if, well, Navalny's bad-mouthing me, but I'm actually saying Navalny's, you know, bee's knees.
And Navalny softened his rhetoric.
Well, exactly, because as Anna has said, I mean, he's in a very tough position. Does he look as if he's actually trying to increasingly factionalize an already thoroughly sort of faction-ridden liberal wing? Or does he have to kind of see what he can get from this situation?
Anna?
Well, actually, a couple of things. In terms of what exactly is the Kremlin trying to achieve with this? It's tempting to at first say, oh, well, they have this play. Actually, this looks like a very short-sighted, opportunistic thing. I was talking to a former
on whose part?
On both of their parts. This is the striking thing. I think this is a case where both sides came together in a mutually beneficial interaction, and both got something out of it, and everybody's okay with what they got out of it. But it's really not for the greater good, and it's not really part of any long-term strategy. Former Kremlin official I was talking to recently about this mentioned specifically that, well, you know, it's been clear that Sobchak has always wanted something like this. She's ambitious. She's got political ambitions. What do those political ambitions really mean? It means just basically airtime. So you've got a willing person, you know, ready to do this, and you've got the Kremlin talking about, okay, we need to kind of sex this up. And it's interesting that I think when they when this news leaked that they wanted a female candidate, I think that was clearly, I mean, it was like with Sobchak clearly in mind. And then we hear Sobchak saying that she mentioned this to Putin when she was doing a film about and then, but then she says, but no, I wasn't asking anybody's permission. She also says she mentioned this to Navalny, but she doesn't say what Navalny's response was. And then she says, no, we did not, I did not ask anybody's permission. I mean, she's not. It looks to me, based on her statements, that she's really not even trying to make this into any sort of cohesive, serious political platform. And nor does she really need to. And look, I have to say, I admire Ksenia. I think she's intelligent. I think she is serious. She is very intelligent, and she. I think that. It's a shame that she's not taken more seriously by people, but the reality is she's not. And what's going to happen is that by doing what she did, we also have to remember that the culture, the mentality within the opposition is very punitive towards any sort of perceived or real collaborationism. I mean, that is something that you just, this goes back from the dissident, comes from the dissident days, and it's still very strong. This is not considered a respectable thing to do. That's really going to tarnish her standing with, you know, serious people who are seriously opposed to the Kremlin and want to build a future beyond it. Now, I tend to disagree with this idea. I really think that the best bet is, as you said in the beginning, Brian, it's good to collaborate between somebody who's on the inside and somebody who's on the outside. It's good to have people with liberal or reformist tendencies within some sort of positions of power, whether that's municipal or regional or administration or whatever. It is good to collaborate. But this is not quite a collaboration. This is a show. This is Ksenia Sobchak getting basically free PR from the Kremlin in exchange for the Kremlin getting an opportunity to further divide and denigrate the opposition.
That's fine. I realize I'm an outlier here on this, and I was an outlier from the beginning. But let's run with another that she's turning the election into a farce. Doesn't, and Mark, you very eloquently put this in your column today, where you said that first it was supposed to be a coronation, then it was supposed to be just something they had to manage. I forget how you phrased it. And then you said, but now it's turning into a farce. Well, if you're Navalny running your campaign against the campaign, or your non-campaign against the campaign, making fun of the fake election, doesn't this serve his purposes, even if he just lets that happen?
The thing is, if he just for him to really take fullest advantage of it, he would have to turn against Sobchak. I mean, actually, if he really wants to play this card to the fullest, he should be turning around and saying, oh, for God's sake, you know, people of Russia, I've been saying the whole democratic process is basically just a farce that is being managed to hoodwink you, and now here is the proof. This is the problem. I mean, either he has to basically join in with the Sobchak bashing, which creates problems within the wider liberal movement, or if he's going to give Sobchak kind of credit and try and sort of suggest that she is actually a real grown-up candidate, then he can't do that. I mean, I think this is where actually it creates some interesting and difficult tensions for Navalny as to how he plays the Sobchak factor.
Which probably explains why he's not said so much about it. And I'd like to add, we're recording this podcast on Thursday rather than Friday, which we normally do, and where maybe some developments will happen after we record it, but before we post it. There's a couple other things I wanted to hit on before we moved on to the second half. Sobchak's against all gambit. I mean, I actually thought this was pretty clever. Against all was taken off the ballot under Putin. It existed in the Yeltsin period. And she's basically, practically said she would change her name to Protiv Siach, you know, to get this on the ballot, right? Which is pretty interesting. How do you interpret that gambit? Because I thought that was, she's lowering the bar in terms of what is success.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I apologize for those of our listeners who really enjoy it when we're arguing, because here I actually have to agree with you. I think it was a clever move. And again, I think particularly because it's very hard to articulate at this stage a coherent and serious political platform. I mean, she said all the right things. She's, you know, for a Russia that doesn't have corruption and so forth. Yeah, that's nice. But there is no kind of costed out campaign here. There is no seven steps that we would do to get rid of corruption. So actually, you know, she needs to have something that is very, very clearly, understandable, and it taps into what is indeed a very real issue within Russia, which is actually that people may not yet see any kind of opposition, particularly because many still don't know really about Navalny or anything like that, or even don't know if they trust him or what really he stands for. But on the other hand, there is clearly a very wide level of dissatisfaction with aspects or the toto of the system. And therefore, I think, you know, in that respect, she has something that people can instantly get. It doesn't require a 45-page manifesto. It actually gives you something to hold on to. The problem is, though, that it does leave you open for the you are just a gadfly spoiler candidate. And I think, again, this is going to be the issue, and I think this is a tension that we've seen within the Sobchak campaign, is does she want to be to appear like she's a real serious candidate with a program, or is she essentially a single issue person just simply trying to draw attention to something? We haven't yet seen her.
And there were reports today in the Russian media that there's dissent within her team, which is still being formed on that issue and on the
Well, again,
the
I mean,
if,
going
issue.
Back to this business of her team, I mean, exactly, these are heavy hitters. You don't necessarily need them if your only message is going to be, look, it's time to actually say that we're sick of the status quo and something needs to change. We're not quite sure what it is, but something needs to change. That's a very simple message. You don't need the likes of Belkovsky to articulate that. So I think the natural pressure from the team will be precisely to head towards a kind of real manifesto, and that'll be an interesting challenge.
Anna, what's your take on the Protiv Vsekh gambit?
I mean, it basically takes this down a notch from Prokhorov. I remember very clearly this visceral disillusionment, even that Prokhorov himself explained when he, I mean, first with his falling out with Surkov, and then that was even before he ran for president, and when he realized that he was being used. It's as though he had some sort of illusion that we can still do something, and then he was told no. And everybody who, I remember people who came to his press conference, people who were going to vote for him, they felt so betrayed and so used, not by Prokhorov, by Prokhorov too. It's like the sentiment I've heard was, we believed that, you know, you thought you had this, that you were on top of this, and then you yourself admitted that you'd been used. Doing this a second time when it's just clear they're using you, you know.
But Prokhorov didn't do the Protiv Vsekh game, though.
No. Well, that's what I mean. I mean, there's a good honesty here that at least both the Kremlin and Sobchak are like, okay, that's it. I mean, we're not going to pretend it is anything else than what it is. This is just against all. But what does that actually achieve, really? Is that going to, like, take votes away from Putin? I don't think it's going to do that in any considerable sense. Does it give people a way to vent? Sure, but I think, I mean, the main purpose of this from the Kremlin standpoint is just to sex up the election, give people something to talk about, a way to, take digs at the opposition. I think what's really sad about this, I'm looking at this from just my own experiences seeing Navalny and Sobchak during the Bolotny days. I was in Astrakhan. I saw them at a rally together interacting, and it was just kind of makes me sad that, you know, that this is happening, that, you know, that not that they're like on different sides of the barricades. They're not. It's just that's precisely it. It's just not clear. There are no barricades. And that's why even this against all line is kind of, even on Sobchak's part, Yeah, I guess it's like there's a sense of, yeah, well, what else can you expect? I noticed the talk show host, Ivan Urgant, did a really funny take on Sobchak's first campaign video. He basically put on a wig, stood in his kitchen, and just said absolutely random nonsense that was really funny. I mean, it wasn't a vicious take because they're friends. It was all like, hey, we're all in this together, haha. But no one's taking this seriously at all. He compared the against all option to, he said, well, once upon a time we had nationalities in our passports, and that was taken away from us. And what that means is that meaning is meaning, and therefore meaning is meaning. It's like, just he went on about it to basically say, I think what is essentially a really powerful point: there is no meaning to any of this. Sobchak could be saying anything. She could be saying that she's against all. She could change her name to against all. She could change her name to Zhirinovsky, and it's not going to mean anything.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I agree with that, actually. And I'm looking at this election, and it's not an endpoint, but a point in a process that is inevitably going to be leading somewhere, right? This regime is going to evolve, and eventually it's going to end sooner or later. And this is a step in that, in this evolution or devolution.
But if in the process it, for example, wounds Navalny and also makes the liberal wing of politics, from the perspective of the overwhelming majority of Russians, who are not especially liberal, but they are disgruntled, makes the liberal wing look as if they're just flighty socialites, social media addicts, and just basically not serious people, then I think actually this could be problematic. I mean, the irony is, I think this is unlikely, in my opinion, to strengthen the state. I think actually quite the opposite. It will weaken it.
That's the heart of my position.
But it might also actually weaken the liberal opposition wing.
I'm not sure it can be any weaker.
If it takes Navalny down a notch, if it makes, I don't makes
see.
Him
see,
damaged.
I don't see it. I just don't see it taking Navalny down a notch. I don't see that. Navalny's on the outside. He's the martyr here. He's not allowed to run. He's the one with the badge of all that jail time.
If he seems to have a vicar on earth, And she turns out to be this bubbly socialite who, let's face it, at any time the Kremlin could probably drop some leak of precisely a document that said, in the presidential administration we had a meeting with Ksenia Sobchak and she agreed to be our patsy. I mean, in other forms. I mean, they could probably, I mean, maybe they genuinely have that compromise, but they could certainly claim it. Mm-hmm. And let's be honest, I've seen nothing to suggest that Sobchak has the kind of visceral strength to kind of put up with the sort of pressure that, for example, Navalny, let alone Udaltsov, has had to face. I mean, there's all kind of ways in which actually this could be made to look really bad.
Now, there's something we got to remember here. Navalny also has support on the inside. I mean, that's an open secret in Moscow, right? I mean, it's widely believed he's not getting the compromise he's getting on top officials without some assistance on the inside. And it's long been believed that he does have his supporters in the establishment. Not that he's a Kremlin tool by any stretch of the imagination, but he's not entirely on the outside. So we're not really comparing. I mean, if we're going to tar Sobchak with this, I think we also have to be honest about Navalny.
But there's a difference. I mean, I don't think there is any kind of plan Navalny. There is no one in the presidential administration running Navalny. He has no curator. Yeah, there are some people within business who contribute to his foundation. And clearly, no one who is big and powerful in business is a complete outsider from the system. Mm-hmm. And likewise, I mean, I can't help but wonder in some ways Navalny maybe plays the same role as WikiLeaks. If you want to get something out there against the other side, then Navalny is the guy. If you want to sort of drop some compromise on someone you don't like, you pass it. But I don't think that's the same as saying that there is actually some kind of state.
I'm sure you've heard the speculation that there are those in the inside who want to have somebody on the other side of the ramparts with whom they can talk if the whole thing comes.
But
they're
individuals, exactly, as individuals. I mean, this is it.
Factions, clans.
Maybe. But again, this is not about the state playing. You know, as it were, this is not the equivalent of going back to sort of like late czarism and all these sort of police unions and such like. You know, the sort of Father Gapon and all the other kind of thing. No, I mean, there are individuals who absolutely, because everyone is basically a pragmatic solipsist in this system. Everyone is thinking about what's in their interests, and some people are thinking, well, we might want to protect ourselves from the future. But I think that those are as individuals rather than suggest as any kind of wider project.
I would argue groups of individuals and even clans. Anna, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I was smiling.
You smiling. That's why I was.
Oh, sorry.
I was saying something ridiculous or something funny.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I wanted to say it's not because you were saying something ridiculous at all. It's just because it just reminds me of just how closed this system is. We ultimately don't know anything.
We don't know.
We don't know who supports him. All we can do is project that there must be somebody who does. Maybe that sure is plausible, but how exactly that support is structured and how that's going to translate, we have absolutely no way of knowing. We're just guessing. And the other thing is that,
I mean, things like him being allowed to run for mayor, things that he's free, you know, or with a 20-day stint here and there, which only burnishes
the credentials.
Yeah, but
that's not somebody. That's not like, that doesn't necessarily mean he's got one person whispering in Putin's ear that we've got to like take care of Navalny. It's like somebody gets together and thinks, oh, you know what? I think it might be a good idea not to jail Navalny because, you know, such and such, or it might be a good idea to let him run for mayor. I think those are the kind of conversations that might be happening. And then they decide, you know, either which way. But I think the second point is that, let's say he does have help from above. Let's say it is an open secret that Navalny is supported from within. This is talked about a lot in the street. And I think that this is precisely the kind of thing that the Kremlin could turn against Navalny once again. To say that, this is exactly the kind of demoralizing background noise that makes people who are exasperated and are looking for something genuine and genuinely, opposition, somebody with a vision, to question that vision and to fall back on the, you know, that pure cynicism that we here in Moscow are all too used to. Right? It's funny how, and it's not even that the Kremlin has to do this deliberately, can just benefit from this talk about Navalny being supported from above, just as it can benefit from any sort of fallout between Navalny and Sobchak. That's not because the Kremlin is in a strong position, it's just because, frankly speaking, civil society is in a weak position.
Mark, you wanted to jump in.
Just very briefly, I mean, again, let's go back to the business of Navalny running for Moscow mayor. I mean, it's clear that Sobchak wanted that. Sobchak was lobbying very openly for that because exactly Sobchak made a calculation. It's not, I think, because he was a deep dyed-in-the-wool liberal. He made a calculation that this actually, that he would still win, but on the other hand, it would increase the legitimacy of his win dramatically. And I think that's a suitable metaphor for a lot of these calculations. It's not often that with people thinking, well, Navalny, he's a good lad and he's got great ideas. It's rather that sense of a cost-benefit analysis. Do we just, you know, stick him in prison and throw away the key? Or actually, is it actually going to be more to our advantage to allow various things? And therefore, I think these are the very much the kind of the pragmatic calculations that are constantly being run.
One last thing I want to hit before we move on to the second half is Sobchak's comments on Crimea. How did you both read those? How did you interpret them? What did you make of them? Anna, you're the, because I went on video and said what I thought. So,
I hate to say it. Again, this goes against Navalny. And yeah, she said that she doesn't agree with him on everything. But it also goes against a great deal of, the idea that Crimea is ours is just so deeply ingrained, even among Navalny supporters, that I'm not really sure what she's going to achieve with this. that's talking to, I think, what is a very narrow contingency, even the Bolotny protests, that's, you know, limited to the urban creative class in Moscow and St. Petersburg.
I mean, I argued
almost saying that, look, I'm with you guys on this, like, and I'm okay with not expanding further to include people who feel viscerally that Crimea is ours and this is like the only good thing that Putin has done. Now, that, again, she has a point. Yes, legally, Crimea belongs to Ukraine, but this isn't about how. This does not reflect how people feel in Russia.
No, although I don't know. I tend to think when politicians say unpopular things, that's sometimes a good thing. My argument was that this is putting this in the public discourse, no matter how unpopular it is. I saw that as a positive thing to have somebody say that openly and clearly.
I agree with you there that the one positive thing about her candidacy is that exactly she's going to be airing things. She's going to be raising questions. She's going to be starting debates. She's going to have a platform to do so, whether that's Navalny or Crimea or anything. That really is a positive thing. It's just politically speaking, in terms of how that's going to structure the opposition, how that's going to help Navalny, it's not. Is it going to help civil society in the long run? Sure, any sort of debate, any sort of open discussion does. But then again, the Kremlin doesn't really deny that. The Kremlin likes discussion. It benefits from it.
Mark, your thoughts before we move on.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, we should mention that over time she's had different perspectives
on
Crimea. But fine, we all get to change our minds. Yeah, it's interesting because of all the sort of hot button issues to go for, that was quite a strange one because it's one that we in the West pay a great deal of attention to, whereas exactly most Russians are thinking, what is this lunacy? Of course, Crimea is ours. Yes, that brings it into public debate, and that's always a good thing. I mean, this is kind of the flip side of the whether Westerners should go onto RT. But at the same time, one has to think about the mouthpiece. Again, I mean, unfortunately, when you have someone who's not regarded as a serious person saying this, again, it makes it look as if it's just a hobby horse of an out of touch wealthy liberal types. But again, bit by bit, these things all creep into the public imagination. Is it going to make a difference in the span of this presidential campaign? Of course not. But is it going to have a longer term, lingering impact? We can hope so.
And that's what I think this is all about. It's not about this presidential campaign, the result of which we know today. And that's on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at reports that the Kremlin is floating plans to forget about all this election stuff and just keep Putin in power indefinitely. I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, The Vori, which will be published next year. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is journalist Anna Arutunyan, author of the book The Putin Mystique. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Президент это навсегда.
Нет. Не, ну хотелось, чтобы он вечно правил.
Не знаю, у нас же никто не вечен.
Меня вообще это не волнует.
Вечно это неправильно.
Не будет.
Будет долго еще.
Я буду за.
До конца своей жизни.
Потрясающе. Ну факт.
What if they just got rid of the facade? What if they just quit the charade? What if they just gave up the pretense of holding elections? Everybody knows they're fixed. Everybody knows they're stage managed and choreographed. Everybody knows the results are preordained. Russia is effectively ruled by Vladimir Putin and a handful of his closest cronies. So why not just formalize the process? Well, according to a report in the Ruski Monitor, some of the more powerful people in Putin's inner circle are thinking along these lines. State Duma Speaker Vyacheslav Volodin has been pushing a plan to create a new Russian state council along the Chinese model that would become the country's primary executive body, according to the report. Vladimir Putin would then be named the council's chairman and effectively turning him into Russia's supreme ruler for life. Putin, according to the report, quote, would become not simply the president of the state council, but also the spiritual and national leader of Russia, end quote. Now, as Paul Goebel noted on his blog, the report is very poorly sourced. But at the same time, it's consistent with other things we've been hearing. In his latest Politburo 2.0, for example, the very well-connected political analyst Yevgeny Minchenko wrote that an extra presidential office is likely to be created for Putin, turning him into something akin to, quote, a Russian Ayatollah. Now, for me, this reflects several things, leaving aside the veracity of this report. These things reflect the anxiety, the very real anxiety in the elite over next year's elections, which the Kremlin, quite frankly, appears less and less confident about stage managing. They reflect a fundamental problem of Putinism, which is highly personalized and predicated on the authority of just one man. And finally, they reflect the age-old Russian problem of succession, something they've never really gotten a handle on. Mark, again, leaving aside the veracity of these specific reports, the Ruski Monitor report, the Minchenko claim, does it make sense to you that the Kremlin would try something like this?
I can see the temptation. I'm not convinced that it actually would eventually sort of succumb. But I can see why they're sort of playing with ideas like this and sort of rolling it around their mouth and thinking, oh, do I like the flavor or not? And it's not so much the elite as particularly the people who are closest to Putin, who we also know, you know, were the people who were lobbying him to return to the presidency after the Medvedev interregnum.
Indeed, before.
But beyond that, I think, look, and it's always kind of problematic, but as you know, I've said this in the past, that I think Putin himself is actually a bit tired of this tedious ruling lark. He would much rather reign. Mm-hmm. He seems more and more disconnected in so many different ways, whether it's physically not even going to the Kremlin or in policy terms or even in just in terms of when those few times we do see him in public. But of course, this is the problem. I don't see Putin as the kind of authoritarian leader who's interested purely in terms of, you know, how many millions and billions can you stash away in your Swiss bank accounts and then you flee to nice, non-extraditable, agreeable climate locations. I think he actually would want to stay in Russia. But how can he do that safely? How can he do that with not just his legacy protected, but also his actual personal security, given that, you know, however many, you know, there are armies of skeletons waiting to troop out of those closets. Mm-hmm. So in this respect, I mean, you know, one approach is to see if you can find this magic successor who is both loyal now and loyal in a year and 5 years' time. And, you know, there clearly has been a surge
There's
a
only
successor.
So many Medvedevs to choose from.
Well, and even Medvedev. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why Putin had to return, is that sense of even Medvedev, bless little Medvedev socks. Nonetheless, after a few years behind the big desk, I think he was beginning to think that he was a real boy. And you saw him doing things that clearly were kind of politically actually sort of parking his tanks on Putin's lawn, like when he went to the Kuril Islands and started talking about security, which up to that point had been very much Putin's bailiwick. So I think if even Medvedev might turn on you.
You got me thinking about Medvedev's socks, which is not the image I want. But this is the other alternative.
So if you can't find a successor, then precisely you have to find. And ironically enough, even in this deinstitutionalized state, you have to reinstitutionalize it to the degree where precisely you can create some position, some, you know, grand high poobah position, which doesn't involve Putin in any kind of managerial role, but exactly this sort of the kind of father of the nation thing. But of course, even that, you know, how do you create that when you deinstitutionalize it? See, the Chinese model has the Communist Party.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the rock-solid foundation on which all these other structures, and we've seen now with the sort of near apotheosis of the current president. But you haven't got that. And the thing is, therefore, you can create any structures you want. You can create a state council. You can take, I remember when Zhirinovsky was singing the Tsarist anthem to Putin, a particularly kind of bizarre bromance moment. You can do any of those things. Someone else can change it next year. Mm. I think that is the ultimate challenge.
Anna, you wrote a book called The Putin Mystique, and a lot of Putin's power and authority is indeed predicated on his popularity and that he seems to embody the will of the people, the will of the nation. Can Putin maintain this mystique without the legitimization ritual of elections?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think the elections are not the only legitimization of the Putin mystique. But I mean, I do want to point out how similar this initiative sounds to what I was hearing in 2007, 2008 mm-hmm. from people around the Kremlin. And it wasn't so much that the Kremlin was mulling these plans as much as people around Putin wanted to lobby this. Hey, look, how are we going to, you know, right. function? We need a go-to person. And we need to legitimize that somehow. And how do we do that? That's always been a question. Because I think what the Putin mystique is, what this mystique is a rule in the absence of institutions, a rule in the absence of rule of law. And in that regard, what Marx said about how do you secure your safety after you're no longer in power, that's a very important thing. We're talking about really a monarch here, a tribal leader who by nature is given the mandate to rule until he is dead. It's like in Game of Thrones, you win or you die. So, I mean, I'm exaggerating here. I mean, it's not quite that literal. But that sense of inevitability, that sense of paternalistic reliance on a natural king, that's still going to be there. And even if we are building an institutionalized state, even if civil society is moving towards some sort of more effective and stronger democratic process, maybe that isn't such a bad idea. Maybe it's a way to wean people off of this type of leadership. Maybe putting him in some sort of nominal role where he still wields power, he still has authority, people can still go to him to arbitrate something. But then again, you know, he basically lets things function the way that allows people to run things on their own, not like he did as prime minister, but in a more in a further removed role. That might actually be a possible compromise in transitioning from one type of paternalistic rule to actual functioning democratic institutions.
I would have agreed with that back in 2011 when it looked when we were wondering whether Medvedev was going to get a second term and what Putin was going to do. And remember, people were talking about the Deng Xiaoping option or the Iranian supreme leader option. And I thought at that time that may have been a good transition where Russia could kind of transition into a more from managed pluralism to real pluralism. Now I'm not so certain about that. And I think this would be a mechanism simply to make Putin the ruler for life. Do you take these reports seriously? And I heard them back in 2007 as well. I heard them in 2011. And now, surprise, surprise, we're hearing them again now. And I think this is an early response to something I wrote about on the blog a couple of weeks ago about this fears that Putin, after his re-election, his inevitable re-election in March, is going to be an effective lame duck, right? And so this is a way out of that puzzle. Do you take this seriously? Do you think this is seriously being considered? Would it surprise you if they did this?
I think it's a long shot that they would do this. What does it mean? Are people considering this? Yes. I think the very fact that this is being reported means somebody in the Kremlin is considering this. Is this Volodin? We don't know. Very often I get the sense that, and this is a very long-term like a pattern I see, is that let's say Volodin came up with a plan and somebody leaks it. What that actually means is not that Volodin came up with a plan. It's somebody is trying to.
It could be somebody. Yeah, Volodin exactly. Well, yeah. And judging from where Ruski Monitor is on the spectrum, I would suspect that's the case. Interestingly, the report said that Volodin was pushing this. The Siloviki liked it, although that Mark would jump in here and say the Siloviki is not one monolithic thing. Which Siloviki? And it said that it's opposed by the Semya, by the family. Now, that is a reference to, I really wasn't quite sure, unless it meant like holdovers from the Yeltsin era who still had influence in the Kremlin.
The family in that context is exactly, it's the Rotenbergs, it's the Timchenkas, it's the people around him who are not part of any of the sort of functional factions, but on the other hand, desperately need to have Putin or a Putin.
But they're against it, according to the Ruski Monitor. They identified it as Simya, without saying what that was.
But this is it, because I think the whole point about this thing is exactly, it takes Putin out of the direct management. I mean, if this is just simply to be, oh, well, you're still president, but we've got a new title and you don't have to be elected anymore, then Putin's still going to do all this damn ruling business. I mean, very much the way this is framed is exactly, it takes, you know, it's father of the nation, it's kind of paternal, symbolic, iconic stuff, while other people actually manage. And you might well still have a president. Whatever. And again, I think from the point of view of this sort of, this new family, you know, they want their guy to be actually handling the day-to-day nuts and bolts of who gets the massive contract to build a bridge somewhere. That kind of thing, which is actually apparently one of the few areas where Putin still is really embedded in that. But in many ways, I mean, he's in the same position as Napoleon, who his own frame, the way he framed his situation, was he'd made himself emperor. But precisely, he'd made himself emperor. He was facing all these kind of inbred crowned heads of European states. And he could smash their armies on the battlefield, and he could chase them out of their countries. But they were still ultimately regarded as the legitimate heads of their state, and their people would still want them back, or their successors. Whereas Napoleon knew that basically when he loses, he loses. So I think, again, the problem is this. Putin has indeed a mystique. He has a lot of practical support, and he has this role. But at the moment, as things stand now, he doesn't have the kind of security of legitimacy, of that kind of deep, ingrained, bred in the bone legitimacy. And just creating state councils wouldn't do it. I mean, ironically, go back to it, if Navalny or someone like Navalny were truly cynically pragmatic but definitely wanted to move the locomotive of history forward, I mean, they'd be saying to Putin, look, you can enjoy your $20+ billion that you've salted away. We're going to put a statue of you in every street, in every city. We're going to name streets after you. And we're going to give you an exalted position where you'll be safe. But you won't be running the country anymore, and we'll stop the stealing now. And I think that's exactly why people like the family are against it, because the danger is that this state council could, or some similar structure, could theoretically, I don't think it's going to happen, but theoretically, it could be precisely a way in which you, as it were, buy Putin out of the political situation, and you allow him to strand.
I mean, the reason I included this in today's program is because I see this as one of the fundamental questions going forward. Putin's about to become a lame duck, and how are they going to handle that? What are they going to do?
I think it's a bit of a stretch to call him a lame duck.
Well, I mean, as soon as he starts his next presidential term, he's essentially, according to the current constitutional system, unless they want to go through this charade again 6 years down the road with a castling and so on, or if he wants to tear up the Constitution, he's effectively a lame duck for six. And people are going to be jockeying about what happens next. I think they want to get ahead. There are those that want to get ahead of that. And I think there's going to be some maneuverings going forward. I think this is one of the key questions. What mechanism are they going to come up with to either put Putin in this exalted position, continue him as hands-on president for life? This is coming to that point now. We thought we were there in 2007, 2008. We thought we were there in 2011. I don't think there's any escaping.
But this is also one way, if you are a member of the upper elite and you see that Putin is looking for options, looking for escape options, frankly, and one of them is a successor, that might well scare the hell out of you. Because the successor, sure, even if we assume this person is going to be loyal to Putin, it's not necessarily going to be loyal to everyone who has done so well out of it. Exactly the same way that Putin was loyal to Yeltsin, but certainly not to Yeltsin's family.
Right.
So, I can imagine precisely when you have people, as I said, whether you use the term lame duck, which I think makes Putin sound a little bit too...
too lame.
Clawless, exactly. I mean, I sort of said it before. In some ways, he's a lame double-headed eagle with sharp claws. But yes, exactly. Given that something is going to happen, this is one way you might get round the risks of Operation Successor.
Mm-hmm. Very last word to you, very briefly, Anna, as we're about to wrap it up.
Yeah, I think lame duck is it's not quite the same thing as what lame duck means for. In a Western context,
understood.
Yeah, because you're basically that's a context where you're power really does depend on your ability to win an election. This does not really apply to Putin. So there is, he might be a lame duck in the sense that people are already envisioning a future after Putin. That's a very important
thing.
He's
a lame duck Paderewski.
But that's still different. That does not mean that he's a lame duck in the sense that he has no influence or his power is diminished. It means that people are thinking ahead to a time after Putin. That's incredibly significant in the way that they frame their political choices. And we're going to see that developing down the line. But again, it actually might that might be possible to envision that with Putin in some sort of for life position, nevertheless.
Now we'll be watching for this going forward. And that's all we have time for today. So we'll wrap it up. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and author of the forthcoming book, The Vori, which will be published next year and which I'm really looking forward to. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow has been journalist Anna Artunyan, author of the book, The Putin Mystique. Thank you both for an enlightening and lively discussion.
Yeah, it's been great.
It's been fun.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.